skull had been struck at least 3 times.
The man, a victim of a grisly murder. The assailant, unknown.
He was a phantom. He was a ghost.
3,000 miles away, a 7-year-old child is abducted.
Attention all units for kidnapping.
The girl, a member of one of America's most prominent families.
She was a danger. He wasn't going to let anybody have her.
An international manhunt for an exchange student with a dark past begins.
How can you lie to somebody for so long?
If he borrowed a chainsaw, it was to do something very, 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 very bad.
The enduring mystery is why. Why did he do what he did?
In depth, insightful, in a class of its own. America's leading journal, Vanity Fair, investigates the perfectly sinister Mr. Rockefeller. It's a warm spring day in San Marino, California, an exclusive suburb of Los Angeles.
You have to understand the city of San Marino. It's a very exclusive, wealthy neighborhood.
Workers digging a pool in this backyard make a startling discovery.
The man on the backhoe, he hit something hard. They stop the construction, they go down to the pit where the pool is being built.
The contractor came up with part of a plastic container.
And inside the plastic container was human bones and a human skull. And they found the remains of a young man. It was in pieces because of decomposition.
The police investigation uncovers a missing persons report filed a decade earlier by the previous homeowner, Didi Sohas, for her 27-year-old son, John, and his new wife, Linda. Could the skeleton belong to one of them? Investigators dig into the couple's past.
John was very smart, computer programmer who loved Star Trek but was very short.
John Sohas was an early computer guru. He was building computers before anybody, and he worked at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena.
And Linda was this 6-foot tall redhead who worked at a science fiction bookstore, and she was an avid artist of flying unicorns and fanciful objects. They moved in with Didi Sohas, and that's when the real mystery began.
Didi Sohas did not think that Linda Sohas was good enough for her son, so they were desperate to make some money and get out on their own.
In February 1985, John and Linda tell family and friends they have been hired for an important job with a U.S. government satellite program and must leave town immediately for New York.
John and Linda were just starting their life. They really didn't have any money. He wants to make a life with his wife. He wants to be better than, you know, what he's doing.
Months pass, and Linda's sister begins to worry because she has not heard from the couple. So she calls Didi Sohas.
And Didi said, no, they're not missing. They're on a secret mission, and I can't tell you anything more about it. I'm not going to jeopardize their jobs, but we know they're fine.
As proof, Didi tells Linda's sister that she's received postcards from the couple.
There's at least 4 postcards that arrive in April of 1985. The 3 we have are all postmarked from Paris, France. They're all written by Linda.
They were supposed to be going for this mysterious government job in New York City, but these postcards came from Paris, France, and Linda would write things like, oops, Miss New York, but this is not bad. You know, we're in Paris. And people thought, wow.
But 5 months later, when the postcards stop coming, Didi begins to worry and files a missing persons report.
In April or May of 1985, she calls San Marino Police Department, and they come out.
Dee Dee tells police about a former tenant who might know what happened to the couple. 24-year-old Christopher Chichester, a film student at USC who just left San Marino. Dee Dee believes he is the one who helped John and Linda land this secret government job.
And she's very distraught now because the person at the guest house disappeared.
They began looking for this man, Christopher Chichester. He was a person of interest in this missing persons case. They weren't able to find him.
They have no leads, and have no idea where Chichester is. They have no idea what happened to John and Linda Soas, so the case just goes cold.
What happened? Nobody knows for sure. It's one more aspect of this story that's so mysterious in so many ways.
Dee Dee Soas dies in the fall of 1988, just weeks before there's finally a break in the case. The truck owned by John and Linda Soas turns up 3,000 miles away in Greenwich, Connecticut. A Chris Bishop tries to buy it from someone named Christopher Crowe, who claims he was a former television producer.
Christopher Crowe was the producer of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which was the new television series based on Alfred Hitchcock mysteries.
California investigators send photos of the missing couple and Christopher Chichester, hoping the Connecticut police can determine if Bishop or Crowe have seen them.
Detective Dan Allen from Greenwich Police Department goes to Chris Bishop to find out what's going on with the truck. Shows him a picture of Chichester, and he goes, no, that's Chris Crowe.
Investigators track down Christopher Crowe in New York City. The man once known as Christopher Chichester is now working for the prestigious securities firm Kidder Peabody & Company.
They went to his place of business in New York City, and he was inconveniently gone. Every time they came to the office, they couldn't find him. So then he disappears again off the face of the earth.
A decade later, the bags of bones are unearthed in Dee Dee Soas' backyard. And police renew their efforts to find the mysterious man who was living in her guest house. What does he know about the body buried just outside his front door?
The skull had three major breaks to it. He had been struck at least three times with a blunt object, say like a baseball bat. It was classic blunt force trauma. Each blow made smaller pieces. It shattered into at least 25 pieces. Additionally, there were stab wounds.
There was indication that there was sharp knife wounds through the shirt, which would indicate a stabbing.
There was bags on both hands, both feet. The body was encased in saran wrap, legs, arms, torso, all wrapped in saran wrap. And then there was two plastic bags over his head, and they were secured by like a telephone wire.
They had the bones, and they had this person of interest, but they had no idea of where this person had gone. It was like he had vanished up into smoke.
A vicious killer is on the loose, but police have no leads, only questions. Twenty years after these unidentified remains were discovered in California, another shocking crime is about to occur 3,000 miles away.
Attention all units for a kidnapping that took place Arlington and Marlboro. A white male wearing khaki pants, a 7-year-old female wearing a red and white sundress and red shoes, and that father of took the child about 10 to 15 minutes ago.
I remember the day vividly. It was a Sunday. It was approximately 12:44 in the afternoon. The father had taken his baby from Marlboro Street. There was a social worker, and he was on a supervised visit with a father.
Injured in the kidnapping, the social worker calls the child's mother, Sandra Boss.
The social worker calls the mother and says, I've lost him. He's got her. He's got her. And she comes running.
Sandra Boss had showed up on scene. It was frantic.
A distraught Sandra Boss tells police about her bitter divorce from Clark Rockefeller. She never imagined he would kidnap their 7-year-old daughter. Clark had always been a good father, born to a wealthy and powerful family.
They met in such a charming way, perfectly Clark Rockefeller way. He held a clue party, and he went as Professor Plum, and she came as Miss Scarlet. At that party, I think she fell in love with him.
She's a very pleasant, very down-to-earth person. Everybody likes Sandy. She was one of these people that could be friends with anybody.
She was under his spell. The allure of the mythology of the Rockefellers. Do you know anybody that knows one? You know anyone that hangs out with one? No.
He very quietly would say, I'm from the poor side of the Rockefeller family. But people knew that he was a Rockefeller.
In 1994, Clark and Sandy announced their engagement with a Stilton and Sherry party and set a date for the following year. It'll be a small ceremony with just her parents, her sister, and her husband. Clark has no immediate family.
He had been orphaned at a young age. His parents had been killed in an automobile accident. They were in a fiery crash that rendered both of them dead. They were married on Nantucket at the Quaker Meeting House, and they began a life together.
They were a very loving couple. It was a nice relationship.
I was glad they found each other.
Sandy, a graduate of Harvard Business School, is a highly regarded executive at McKinsey & Company, the influential consulting firm.
Sandra Boss was an extremely intelligent rising star in the financial world.
I believe she was made the youngest full partner, and she was making $1 million a year.
Clark and Sandy settle in New York City. She loves the fact that Clark isn't concerned about material wealth. Rockefeller runs Asterisk LLP, a nonprofit that doesn't charge its third world clients.
He said that he consulted with third world impoverished governments and told them how much currency to print. And he also told me that he was tax exempt by an act of Congress.
After 5 years in New York, Clark convinces Sandra to move to Cornish, New Hampshire.
So they moved to another wealthy community, but this was a really small one, and it was the home of J.D. Salinger, you know, the great reclusive author.
Clark was big news in Cornish when the realtor sold the house to him because she told us that a celebrity came in town and bought the house on the street, but she said, I can't tell you his name. When I did find out he was a Rockefeller, he said, call me Clark. I don't want anyone to know I'm a Rockefeller. So he tried to keep it hush-hush.
While Sandy is often away on business, Clark is an outgoing presence about town.
Clark was extremely friendly with my family to the point of him being almost a part of the family, almost like a brother to me. And he would just walk into the kitchen without knocking and say, hello, who's home?
The most important change in Clark Rockefeller's life comes on May 24th, 2001, when Sandra gives birth to the daughter they lovingly call Snooks.
Clark was a wonderful father. I never thought Snooks was taken care of better by anyone that I knew.
Clark had a reason for being. He became, according to people who knew him, totally inseparable from this child. You know, he would teach her, he would read to her, and she was quite bright. He apparently was very proud, and he had a new life as a father.
But in 2006, when Snooks is ready to enter kindergarten, Sandra insists that she needs to be around other children.
That became their reason to leave Cornish, because she wanted her daughter in a regular school, and so they moved to Boston. And they enrolled their child in Southfield, one of the most prestigious schools in Boston. And then a new life began for Clark Rockefeller in Beacon Hill.
Sandra buys this house on Pinckney Street, where the neighbors include Senator John Kerry. Clark Rockefeller fits right in.
You know, he would be seen walking down the street with his daughter on his shoulders. She was devoted to him, and he was very proud of her.
But Clark and Sandra start to argue over their conflicting ideas about how to raise their daughter.
Snooks was a very precocious child. He would have a very hard time telling her not to do something. He didn't like doing that at all. She kind of had free rein.
They had disagreements over how to raise the child, disagreed over various things about her schooling and how she should be parented. So there was friction in the marriage.
The disagreements end abruptly in 2007, when Sandra, away on a business trip, drops a bombshell.
Sandy had him served with divorce papers, and he was extremely upset. And he was panicked about his daughter, what was going to happen to her, because he didn't want to lose his daughter at all.
While they fight over the divorce and child custody, Sandra and Clark Rockefeller are living a few blocks apart. Snooks shuttles between the two. And Sandra starts looking into Clark Rockefeller's background for the first time since they met 13 years earlier.
He had said that his mother was Ann Carter, who was a Hollywood star. So his father-in-law looked up on Wikipedia and saw that Ann Carter was very much alive. Well, Clark had said that his parents died in a fiery car crash. And the father-in-law wondered, what's the real story? Who is this man? Nobody knew.
It is the first of many lies that would unravel the myth of Clark Rockefeller and lead investigators back to the mysterious bones unearthed in San Marino. Sandra Boss feels like she doesn't know the man she married. Clark Rockefeller lied to her about his parents' death. Their divorce turns into a bitter courtroom battle that finally ends just before Christmas 2007.
The settlement was that he got $800,000 cash, but she got custody of the daughter, and he got a certain number of supervised visits per year.
Sandy bought him off. Obviously, he brokered his rights to the marriage and the child.
The judge approves Sandra's request to take their daughter, 6-year-old Snooks, with her to London, limiting the doting father to only 3 court-supervised visits a year.
Clark was alone, and he lived in Boston, in Beacon Hill still, but in a very small apartment there. He was lost. He was bereft.
When Clark Rockefeller has his first court-supervised visit with Snooks, a social worker is walking close behind as they stroll through the neighborhood. When they approach Marlborough Street, a black SUV suddenly pulls to the curb.
When Rockefeller, with his daughter on his shoulders and the social worker behind them, like a creaky third wheel, came walking down Marlborough Street, Rockefeller pointed out one of the historic buildings to the social worker, and when the social worker turned to look,
Clark pushed him to the ground, grabbed Snooks, and threw her in the car.
And Rockefeller just told the driver, go, go, go. The driver took off, and the social worker was trying to follow them. They drive a little ways, and Rockefeller tells him to let him off at a certain point along the way where he jumped into a cab. And from that point, he instructed the cab to take them to the Boston Sailing Center, where yet another ride was waiting. They get to New York Grand Central. Stop right here, he says, and he throws a packet of money onto the driver's seat. He disappears into Grand Central, and he vanishes again.
With a manhunt underway, Boston police start to question Sandra Boss about her husband.
I was trying to get some information regarding where does he frequent, does he have a phone number, finances, driver's records, social security numbers. There was absolutely zero, nothing.
At the same time, the FBI investigates Rockefeller's personal records and finds nothing.
They couldn't find any proof that Clark Rockefeller existed, that there ever was a Clark Rockefeller before Clark Rockefeller showed up in New York and Boston and all of this. Who was he? He was a phantom. He was a ghost. Even the Rockefellers said they'd never heard of him.
Sandra fears that she's lost her daughter for good.
I truly believe that she thought that was it. She was never going to see Snooks again.
Retracing Clark's movements before the kidnapping, investigators learn he visited a friend's home where he had a glass of wine. A glass which, fortunately, had not been washed. Police discover a single fingerprint and their first real lead to the fugitive dad's true identity.
And it came back that it was a fingerprint of Christian Carl Gerhardt Schrider, who had come to America as a 17-year-old immigrant.
His story begins in Bergen, Germany, a small resort town in the Bavarian Alps, where Christian Gerhardt Schrider grew up a misfit. He was a short, skinny, fantasy-obsessed boy whose father was a house painter and whose mother was a seamstress.
He was fascinated with America. He was fascinated with Alfred Hitchcock movies. He knew film noir. He would sit in his parents' home and watch old movies. And that's how he learned about America.
Hoping that someone will recognize the German immigrant, the FBI releases his picture to the media.
After that All Points Bulletin went out, all of these intricate threads that he had created in this fabric of a fabricated life began to unravel.
The Savio family hosted many foreign exchange students at their Berlin, Connecticut home. Everyone remembers the flamboyant young German with the regal airs.
I think it was an August day, and it was pretty hot, I remember. This guy came up my driveway. He was an exchange student, just dragging a suitcase behind him. And here was this very sort of just feathered hair, the European white sunglasses, and he just sort of blasted into our house. But we got him enrolled in the high school in Berlin, Connecticut, as a senior. He said that his father was an industrialist. He was a big supplier of parts from Mercedes-Benz.
Now calling himself Christopher Gerhardt Schrider, he begins a process of reinvention.
He wanted to be American, you know, he wanted to fit in.
He would sit in front of the television for hours watching his favorite show, Gilligan's Island, because he was fascinated with Thurston Howell III, the rich, eccentric millionaire from the East Coast.
Good news or bad news?
Both. Well, tell us the good news. Bad news is for peasants.
Of course, he liked the Howells. He found He found that lower lockjaw sound very interesting, and he would kind of practice it every once in a while.
Christopher is not one for menial tasks. He expects his breakfast to be prepared and his clothes laundered.
Chris never did anything. You know, my mom would fight with him. You got to do your laundry, Chris. I'm not going to do your laundry. I'm not your housemaid. And he would be like, ugh, laundry is just really that's for poor people.
Years after arriving at the Savio home, Christopher Gerhardt Schrider assumes a new name, Chris Kenneth Gerhardt. He enrolls at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, where he studies film.
He said he was from Boston. He arrived with a pair of golf clubs, and to prove he was from Boston, he ate a Boston cream pie every day.
Desperate to stay in the country, Gerhardt convinces the sister of a friend from a local church to marry him.
They were getting married so he could have a green card that he had convinced her if he went back to Germany, he would be immediately put in the army and could be in grave danger.
Fresh green card in hand, Christopher abandons his wife and his film studies and disappears.
He was on his way to the place where he had dreamed of living apparently all of his life, Hollywood, California, although he didn't quite make it to Hollywood.
By 1982, Chris Gerhart is living 18 miles east of Los Angeles in the wealthy suburb of San Marino. Gerhart's mastered English and has another new name, Christopher Chichester.
He had a card that he would carry saying he was the 13th Baronet of Chichester, England. And people said that he was very elegant and he would kiss the ladies' hands and introduce himself, and he was very charming.
In the mid-80s, Christopher suddenly appeared at our church, and he was there every Sunday morning. Christopher stood out a lot because he was so charming and outgoing and intelligent. He knew about everything. Everyone at the church just thought he was an adorable young man.
He was royalty living in San Marino, and people wanted to be around him.
Just down the freeway from San Marino is the University of Southern California with its celebrated film school. Here, Christopher Chichester also becomes a familiar presence, although there is no record he ever enrolled as a student.
He always walked around with scripts under his arm, and he knew the film librarian, and he knew a lot of the professors, and everything was just a flourish. And, you know, Dana, we must go see Double Indemnity together. You know, it just was very over the top, you know, but he was a lot of fun.
He loved dark mysteries with plot twists and sinister people, and nobody's quite exactly what they seem to be. That's what he really liked.
And here, the film of Christopher Chichester's life turns to noir. The charming imposter's deceptions mask something immensely evil. Christopher Chichester comfortably settles into life in San Marino. He's something of a local fixture by the time he moves, rent-free, into the guest cottage owned by Ruth Didi Sohus.
His landlady was Didi, and she was kind of a neighborhood character. She had been a beautiful young debutante that went to private schools and had this home in San Marino.
She was well off. She was, I wouldn't say super wealthy, but she had a nice home. By the time Christopher Chichester met her, she was living alone.
She drank a lot. She didn't often get dressed or take care of herself. And people kind of knew that poor old Didi was barely hanging on.
Christopher and Didi seemed to hit it off. He runs her errands and keeps her company. But some friends say their relationship changes when Didi's adopted son, John Sohus, and his wife Linda move into her house in 1983.
He had the run of the place before they got there. And once they got there, he probably didn't have as much access that he would have liked.
Then in February 1985, John and Linda suddenly and unexpectedly leave town. Didi tells everyone that they were hired for a top-secret government job that she believes they got with the help of Christopher Chichester.
And then they vanish from the face of the earth, and they weren't seen again.
A few months after John and Linda vanish, so does Christopher Chichester. No one, including Didi Sohus, knows where he is. It's not until police look into the attempted sale of the truck in Greenwich, Connecticut 3 years later that they realize the missing tenant is an imposter who now calls himself Christopher Crow.
He disappears in 1988. He was never Christopher Crow again.
Attention all units for a kidnapping that took place Arlington and Marlboro.
Now, 20 years later, investigators wonder, what does the man who calls himself Clark Rockefeller, a.k.a. Gerhart, Chichester, and Crow, know about John and Linda Sohus? But before they can question him, they have to find him. It's been 4 days since he kidnapped his daughter Snooks in Boston.
Investigators haven't learned much from the evidence collected so far.
Things aren't looking good as far as locating this guy. He had a plan. He's going to execute that plan and get away. I think Clark Rockefeller was a danger. I think that he wasn't going to let anybody have her.
Sandra Boss goes on TV to make a public plea to Rockefeller.
I ask you now, please, please bring Snooks back. There has to be a better way for us to solve our differences.
5 days after the kidnapping, there's a break in the case. A real estate agent recognizes the fugitive's picture on television.
Rockefeller was reportedly recognized by the real estate agent. The agent quickly called in police.
The agent says she just sold that man a carriage house on Ploy Street in Baltimore for $432,000 in cashier's checks.
They saw it on the news. They said they're looking for a guy named Clark Rockefeller. Said, that's not Clark Rockefeller, that's Chip Smith. We just sold him a house. And the FBI set up surveillance of the house and didn't see anything.
The FBI couldn't just barge in because they were concerned about the child's safety.
But after about 12 hours, they saw some movement inside the carriage house. They saw Rockefeller, and they saw that Snooks was in there and she was safe. At that point, they devised a ruse.
From the real estate agent, the FBI learns he has a boat docked in a nearby marina. They get the manager of the marina to call Rockefeller's cell phone and say that his boat is taking on water.
About 15 minutes later, he left the baby there, and he walked out of his house, and the FBI was right outside, and they asked him. They said, Clark, where are you going?
And he tells yet another lie. He says, I'm going to get a turkey sandwich. And at that point, they gang-tackled him to the ground, and the jig was up.
Snooks was obviously found unharmed.
The daughter was fine, reunited with her mother, and Clark Rockefeller was off to jail and to be interrogated.
I'm sick of this. I've been dealing with this all week. Tell me who you are.
Clark Rockefeller.
No, you told me you are not Clark Rockefeller. Clark Rockefeller doesn't exist. I'm talking to somebody here, but it's not Clark Rockefeller. Tell me who you are.
That's the best I can do.
Who are you?
I can't tell you.
Why?
I can't tell you.
All he wanted to talk about was Snooks. He said, I just love her.
She's my child. I just want to be with her. I want to get her up in the morning, send her off to school, walk her to the bus.
Rockefeller's trial for parental kidnapping in Massachusetts begins in May of 2009. Sandra Boss is a key witness.
I'm not saying that I made a very good choice of husband. All I'm saying is that it is possible that one can be brilliant and amazing in one area of one's life and be really stupid in another.
Clark Rockefeller is convicted of custodial kidnapping and sentenced to 4 to 5 years in state prison.
I'd like to be known as a good man. Yeah, I'd like to be known as a quiet man living a quiet life.
Meanwhile, in California, investigators continue to unravel the mystery of the bones buried in Dee Dee Soas' backyard.
The goal of this information was to find out, first of all, if Christian Garestrider had committed this murder.
But first, police need to positively identify the victim. It's a challenging task, as the bones were cremated years ago. Only the skull remains.
And the skull was found in the plastic bags, but it was in small pieces. Department of the Navy has a group of forensic anthropologists who are the best in the world, and they reconstructed the skull and got the DNA match.
Nearly 30 years after John Soas disappeared, tests confirm that he was brutally murdered and buried in his mother's backyard. Police suspect that Gerhardsreiter killed Linda Soas too, but they have nothing to back it up. Gerhardsreiter insists that he has no knowledge of her whereabouts. Police begin building a case against the imposter who many still believe could never kill in cold blood.
This seems really strange. Chris isn't a murderer. He's a con man.
The police have evidence of the crime, but do they have enough proof to convict the con man of murder? LA County investigators want to know, how did John Sovis's body end up buried in the backyard of this San Marino home?
We interviewed over 300 people. I think the number was in the 370s. Our discovery package to the defense team was 70,000 pages of documents.
According to a neighbor, the man who called himself Christopher Chichester borrowed a chainsaw from him around the same time John and Linda were reportedly leaving for New York.
Christian Gerhardt's writer has never done a day of work. He's never done a day of gardening or yard work in his life. If he borrowed a chainsaw from a neighbor to trim the hedges, it was to do something very, 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 very bad.
Friends also remember that the lawn in front of the guest house where Chichester lived had been dug up around the time John Sovis went missing.
He said, why don't you come over? I'm having a little party and we'll play Trivial Pursuit. That was the only time I was ever at his house. The first thing I noticed was that the yard is dug up. And so I said to him, what's going on with your yard, Chris? And he just said, oh, I'm having plumbing problems.
10 years later, John Sovis's remains are uncovered in that same spot. When investigators closely examine the two bags that had been wrapped around the skull, they make an important connection. One is from the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. The other from USC, both schools that Christian Gerhardt's writer attended.
Both bags, by the style, you can date to the years that he was at those institutions.
It is a crucial link to the con man, but not enough to charge him with murder. Police turn to the luminol test for bloodstains conducted in the guest house where Chichester lived.
In the living room area, they found four large stains of blood. This is not someone who cut themselves shaving. You know, this is a lot of blood, and it would have had to soak through carpet. At the same time John Sovis got missing, the next door neighbor said there was a black, thick smoke coming out of the chimney. And she had called him and asked, Chris, what are you burning? And he said, I'm burning carpet.
Investigators want to interview Gerhardt's writer regarding the Sovis case, but he declines from his jail cell in Massachusetts.
It's a 30-year-old case, but they had some very dedicated detectives, including Tim Miley, who felt that they had enough to convict him.
On March 15th, 2011, Christian Gerhardt's writer is charged with murder and transferred to California. He pleads not guilty.
My entire life, I've always been a pacifist. I'm a Quaker, and I believe in nonviolence. And I can fairly certainly say that I've never hurt anyone.
The enduring mystery is why. Why would a young man who has such an imagination and to be able to create all these personalities, why did he do what he did?
The LA Sheriff's Department believes that Gerhardt's writer killed John because John was trying to prevent him from getting Dee Dee's money and property.
He has complete control over Dee Dee Sovis until John and Linda move back into the house. He wants to get that property. The only way to get that money is to get rid of John and Linda Sovis.
In April 2013, a jury convicts Christian Gerhardt's writer of first-degree murder in the killing of John Sovis.
Gerhardt's writer guilty of the crime of murder in the first degree.
I was more shocked that he lied than murdered, because it seems inconceivable that he would murder someone. I don't see it.
He would say explicitly, people are stupid. People are so stupid. He would just say it about everybody.
How can you lie to somebody for so long and be their friend? He was like part of the family. It's painful.
Clark Rockefeller is a mystery man. The district attorney in Boston said he was the perpetrator of the longest con he'd ever seen in his professional career, who came here and created a life of 30 years of incredible Ripley, believe it or not, lies. He's now in the California prison serving 27 years. He's gonna be an old man when he gets out.
At his sentencing, Gerhardt's writer says Linda Sohus is responsible for killing her husband.
I want to assert my innocence and that I firmly believe that the victim's wife killed the victim.
But one big question remains unanswered.
What happened to Linda? That was the question that everybody was asking.
Did Linda actually make it to Paris and send those postcards to Dee Dee Sohus in 1985?
She doesn't have a passport. She had no money. She doesn't have any, you know, friends, relatives, anybody in Paris, France. She falls off the face of the earth.
I believe that he murdered Linda as well as John. Where he hid the body, you know, that's anybody's guess.
She was deeply loved by a lot of friends. People want to know where she is, you know, and I think they deserve answers, but nothing has happened so far.
I think he should let us know where Linda's body is. That way her family can be at peace.